next speaker, Dr. Andreas Weigand, knows quite a lot about how that has been achieved, because he is the former chief scientist of Amazon.com. He is also lecturing at Stanford University and at the University of California at Berkeley, and further to that, he is consulting with companies like Alibaba, Lufthansa, MySpace, and Nokia. So I'm sure he will have actually quite interesting insights into how the consumers are behaving today and actually the consumer data revolution. Andreas, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It actually is an honor to be here. I had a chance to talk to several of you last night, and I was deeply impressed just how smart people are, how international the audience also is. I mean, I travel a lot. I've been on this trip for 7 weeks, and I met people from several countries I have never been at. So thank you, Kimo, for inviting me. Species, and I think I learned in Finland that they're often double letters. So I want to add another S at the end here. I want to say species should also increase end customer sales and satisfaction. Because I think, as Kimo said, we are in the business of long-term stuff. So I think the long-term element of satisfaction is often overlooked when companies look at just A-B tests and short-term experiments. In this talk, I want to talk to you about what I think Amazon.com would do in some cases, which are related to the business you're in. So whenever you see this WAD, it doesn't mean Dutch for what, but it means what would Amazon do? And before I talk about that, I want to tell you a little bit about my own background, what I do. I teach data mining at Stanford, and I teach marketing too at Berkeley. I do consulting, like in Finland, where I was on this trip. If I come to Europe, might as well go to Finland. That's my LDB. I worked with Nokia, and I also worked with F-Secure. So I know a little bit about what I'm talking about here. And I do speeches like this one, and they always, I do one thing. I think about people and the data they create. And you as ISPs, you have probably more data than anybody else in the universe. Of these 100 gigabytes per person in the universe, you probably in the room have at least 10% or something. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Then marketing 2.0, it is not really that there are new techniques about segmentation or things which you can expect from me. Marketing 2.0 actually is people 2.0. So when I think about things, I think about the impact changing economics of communication has on individuals, society, and business. At the heart of it is that people want to be reached differently. People want to communicate because it becomes so cheap. And the attitude to the access often of their own information has dramatically changed. So I'm going to talk about four things in the next 40 minutes or so, and then I leave time for discussion. So please do think about during the conversation I have with you, what do you want to ask afterwards? First, I will talk about it's not just the data. It is really experiments you should be doing so you learn more. So many companies come to me and say, hey, Andreas, what data should we collect? And the conversation quickly shifts to, do you want to be famous? And I explain to you in a moment what that means. The second point is, I want you to think back again what customer centricity really means. And I have a little video which I made here as I bought my SIM card a couple of days ago. The third one is, and people always want to hear that, they want to hear what has changed in recommendations from what Amazon did 10, 15 years ago by now, people who bought X also bought Y, to the social web we live in. And then last one is I'm going to talk about what I call the consumer data revolution or the customer data revolution. What really is changing? What are the implications? I summarize, and then we have some time for conversation. Okay? All right. So the first myth I think many of you have is that at the beginning, there is data. And then you create actual insights. When I was a full-time faculty at NYU as associate professor, I got lots of money from companies giving me money for creating actionable insights. So it was a good term. But then when I went to Amazon, I realized actually that's not quite how the world really works. Yes, of course, yeah, Amazon is a measurement data center culture. But much more important than that, it is an experimental culture. And that doesn't mean that, you know, people wear funny clothes at work, that too. But it means that, you know, it's not that Jeff, who is a wonderful genius, thinks very hard about something and says, this is what you should do. But we discuss things and he said, well, maybe it's this way, maybe it's that way. I don't know. Let's try it out. So just like those guys with the black hats, which we saw before, they tried all kinds of things and some of them work. That's how agile organizations like Amazon or Google actually manage to come up with new things in the business. So it's not top down. It's not going on retreats and drinking good wine. That's a good thing too. And by the way, I think this is a wonderful resort here. I'm not sure who of you had the chance to look out of the window. We are actually at the ocean here. That's absolutely really, really great. I'm all for that. Don't get me wrong. But for getting innovation done, a couple of things need to happen. And what I like to say here is that we move from getting ideas or hypotheses, if you're a scientist, which is a good thing, which you get from looking at data, playing with data, to actions. So what could I do differently? It can be as trivial as how should I change the wording of trying to people to subscribe to F-Secure? Or it could be, how should I change different pricing options, monthly versus annual, so I get most happy customers, meaning safe computers. To experiments, namely running two things in parallel, and that's the data you collect. And are you done then? No, of course not. You go back to the cycle because you typically learn something. And an important element actually is that companies realize that experiments are not done at random, but there has to be some institutional learning. Maybe that you have some change agents within the firm who think about how can we as a whole capture that knowledge in order to come up with new hypotheses and new ideas for actions. This iteration is very important, as sometimes actually we call it the F word, meaning feedback. So when you hear me talking about iterations, it really is a feedback culture, fast feedback culture. Now, Fs I've heard, like phishing, have been replaced by PHs in the world. So I decided to present here the FAME model. What is the problem you're trying to solve? What are the hypotheses you can get by talking to people, doing quick surveys, not very scientific stuff, we're not trying to predict the next presidential election. What are the actions you can derive? Example I gave you was wording. What are the metrics? We spent probably more than half a day in October at F-Secure figuring out what metrics we could have in order to see how we can measure the engagement of customers, how can we measure how are things going. And then you do the experiments and you go back. So why do you want to do the whole thing? I believe that the ultimate goal is to really rethink customer centricity. And for this, I just have a small movie, which I just filmed with my little $300 camera, which I want to show to you. Nothing compared to the professional stuff you normally see. Here we are. Vodafone is a company, and they send me messages because somebody presumably get the idea that I did not top up. I was out of volume. I was out of my money. So look at which frequencies they send me random message: 825, 826, 840, 840, and even in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, 4:25, even earlier, here at 3:25. And at 3:25, the phone rings with a message. I decided I need to do something about it because I couldn't get a good night's sleep. This is really my Vodafone. And so I decided I follow what they say. I looked it up. And here it says, you have insufficient prepaid toilet. To top it up, call 1200. And since I had changed my language to English, as you can see here, I thought, despite being in Holland, I call them up. Unfortunately, I only got Dutch. So that's when I decided it's time to throw away the SIM card. So I'm sure somebody did a very good job there. And I don't want to say something is bad here. Somebody probably has a metric which said, well, if somebody's SIM card needs to be topped up, remind the customer. And they probably measure the time between SIM card running out of money and customer going to top up. And that probably get a big promotion. Because think how the time shrinks. I call them at 3:25 in the morning. What marketing doesn't measure, and that is the important lesson here, is the negative impact on customer perception. of a product. Before running FCQ on this box, I was running Semantic, and one of the things which bugged me was every week I get some message, which then, if I don't do a full system scan, keeps on coming up every 15 minutes. And I probably tried for an hour to find the button to disable it. I didn't find it. Leave people in peace when they were left in peace. Don't talk down to them. So what would Amazon do? Amazon would play and come up with new hypotheses. And the hypothesis I have here is the hypothesis that we might try to change the information flow. Not what can the ISP do for the user, which I'm sure all of you are thinking about very hard. But hey, what can the user do for the ISP? What really has changed in the last years is that people are more than happy to communicate with companies. And just as easy as it is to hit up a friend with a short message, it should be easy to hit up a company with a short message, with a little suggestion. Swiss, for instance, Swiss International Airlines, is implementing a way that the CEO can reach everybody sitting in the lounge right now on their mobile phones and vice versa. At Amazon, I ran the first surveys where I just simply asked people, hey, why are you here today? What do you want to do? And then by relating what they explicitly tell us with what we can implicitly observe through a clickstream, we found out that half of the stuff Amazon sells gets sold to people who had no idea that they wanted to buy something that day. That was good news. The bad news was that only a third of the people who came with an explicit intent to buy leave the shop buying something. But that gives you very, very interesting hypotheses. You can come up with actions. Starting A9, a search company, was one of the actions because we found the product search was pretty bad. And then you test it. You see what happens if you show, for instance, people reviews versus you don't show them reviews, etc. But I'm getting a little ahead of my time here. What I want to talk about right now here is about customer centricity. I want to ask, and that's a theme which will recur later, where do these conversations actually happen? And if you think about it, most of the conversations about viruses, about mobile phones, about pretty much any product doesn't happen by us watching, you know, this reducing percentage of time we do television. I don't have a television anymore. Most of my students, they have television anymore. But it is really people hanging out and talking to each other. Just like, you know, a couple of hundred years ago, people would hang out at the campfire and talking to each other. So it's not that different. There was just this period starting with this guy called Gutenberg, where we destroyed the communication, the bidirectional communication, for a little while. But we are back at this. So the communications happen here, and the advice we can give to companies is very simple. Go to where the communications are. I was at Nokia last week, and I got an E71 phone, and it told me to activate my maps. So I didn't quite know how to activate my maps, so I go to Google, I enter activate Nokia maps, hit return, and none of the hits on the first page at Google had any link to Nokia.com. They told us, probably the same Hong Kong friends you have, how to get it done without paying the 123 euros, and other things, probably more interesting for most people, but Nokia, while they were brushing up the nice images on their pages, didn't realize that's not where people were going to have their problem solved. So just as a little thing, spend some time, maybe an hour, and enter keywords which you think your customers want to know. Rebooting DSL router, as an example. And see whether they land on your page or where they land. It differs from country to country. I realized when I entered Weigand in Holland, I am not the top hit on Google. I was crushed about this. 10 years ago when I entered Andreas, I was a top hit everywhere, but the world has changed. So think, where do people end up, and then devise some hypotheses, come up with some ideas of why that might be why Google sends people who have a certain question to those sites. Google has nothing against you. Google tries to make as much money as they can, fair enough, in order to get people the information they're looking for. And then it's called social media. I'm not going to talk about very much today. That's where you should think about how can you actually influence the mind of the people, because they are probably not looking at their DSL provider's homepage. I, to be honest, I have two independent cables coming to home, cable and DSL, and I've never been to either of them. And I think that's probably true for most people. So go to where the conversations are. In terms of selling more stuff, after all, the first S was for sales, only the second S was for satisfaction. Here's an example from a telecommunications company in the United States. I'm not supposed to tell you what they are called. I tell you that much, they're early on in the alphabet, and they used to have some labs in New Jersey where they had excellent, excellent statisticians who come up with really, really good models. And those models are based on demographic data, geographic data, loyalty data, and so on, because after all, you know, companies do know a lot about my behavior. We now normalize the response rate they got for a new product to 1. So they had 22 groups, they send out stuff. Average of all these groups, the response rate was normalized to 1. It actually was 0.28%, but let's say for simplicity, 1. Then a colleague of mine, former colleague of mine at NYU, Foster Provo, said, you know, phone companies are in the business of connecting people. So if you talk about the social media stuff, Andreas, maybe we just try to market the product to people who have people they talk to who already bought the product. Nothing complicated. You look in your phone records, you find that Charles bought the product. You found that I make phone calls with Charles and I say, hey, Andreas, how about that product? Very simple. It turned out that it was almost 5 times most effective. 5 times more effective. Not 5%, but 5 times more effective. So what we're learning here is that new data sources, in this case, the data source of the social graph, can have much more effect on selling stuff than trying to tweak the old algorithms. So one of the lessons I teach my students again and again is that your creativity should go to try to figure out what other data can you collect. And not just, you know, should I use that published algorithm or should I use that published algorithm. So for selling stuff, and that's the third point I want to make here, recommendations in Amazon's world were pretty much based on clicks. That means that people bought X, also bought Y, the so-called collaborative filtering, by the way, has nothing to do with the individual. You are an individual only for 24 hours. And if you click on more than 2 things, those co-clicking goes in a database and that's it. So it's not what people often talk about. It's because people are similar. Well, yeah, they're similar in the sense that they have clicked on the same item. And that's all we know about you. A couple of twists have happened at Amazon, and then I'll talk about what you could do afterwards. One twist, which I think is very good, is that, as we call it, we want to move further upstream in the decision-making behavior of the individual. So if you only observe the final transactions, people bought X, also bought Y, you primarily look at so-called complements, so what can you buy in addition to something else, cross-selling, but you only see the outcome of their pondering potentially for hours about, let's say, what's virus software to buy. Much more powerful is doing a different matrix. People click at something, eventually buy something else. And Amazon gives you back the explicit percentages. So there you are as a customer wondering whether you should get F-Secure or Semantic or whatever the others are called. And you click on F-Secure. And then it says, people click on F-Secure, eventually buy, and then it's, I think, 87% F-Secure. Now you feel, I can't make a really stupid decision because 87% of the population can't be stupid. Whereas if it would say, you know, you're at the Semantic page and there's, you know, people click at Semantic, 3% buy Semantic down the road, then you feel really you should spend a little more time investigating this. So none of these numbers come from Amazon. All these numbers come from users. They distill the user's intelligence, the user's research for 100 million people, down to helping you as individual make better decisions. So it's a very different model, just based on the clicks, from, you know, here is the org chart mapped out on the web page and tells you what you might want to be buying. I don't know, I'm a small business, having a couple of computers at home, and I don't know these things, but hey, if 87% of the people buy this thing, I'm good. Now, what other attention gestures have happened? Forwarding and telling a friend. Rich data, because not just data about me, but just like the phone data, it's data about the social graph. It's data about other people. And I also have a house in Shanghai. Probably half of us could take my passport, and you would have no problem passing by Chinese immigrations, because after all Westerners look the same. Whereas if any of you grab my Facebook password and try to hit up my friends, I think after 5 minutes, my friends would say, Andreas, anything wrong? Oh, I see you were in Amsterdam. So the relationships are much more stable than the demographics or the psychographics, the sociographics, which typical marketing people measure. Now, why do they measure it? Because in the old world, that's all you knew. But you are all in the business of connecting people. You're all in the business of running pipes. So you can create, you have created the new world, but now it's up to us to figure out what should be flowing through the pipes. Second point is annotation. Annotation is a very good attention gesture. I was yesterday at an amazingly great company in Amsterdam. No, not the coffee shop. No. Booking.com. Not sure whether you've used Booking.com. The website is so-so. What they have behind it is just absolutely stunning. I mean, it's really not what would Amazon do, but what would Booking do, what I sometimes think now. And for instance, if they allow you to have a little field where you can take notes for yourself about certain hotels, as you're in the process of making decisions, money is made where people make decisions. As you're in that process, well, you might not be sure. You might want to ask your friend about those two hotels, but given it's midnight in New York, maybe you'll call tomorrow. So you can put little post-it notes on the page just for you and for Booking. Because Booking, of course, can mine those and thus, again, get further upstream in your decision-making process. So you create value primarily for the end user by supporting his or her decision process. But by doing this, you can help other users as well, and ultimately help yourself. Search is a beautiful data source for intention data. Just sticking to the example of travel here, as I search and I say I want to go to Hong Kong to visit your friend who I can get these numbers from, to Hong Kong from that date to that date, and I want to stay at least in a 5-star hotel because, you know, this friend, you know, is a famous man, that means that now they aggregate demand. They understand demand. They don't need to know when the Hong Kong Convention Bureau has the Hackers Convention. It actually doesn't matter to them. They can just look at the intention data people have. You see so much intention data in any and every individual ISP. Hitwise is very good in aggregation. Hitwise, I'm not sure whether you know it, has more than 10 million individual users and deals with some of the ISPs in this room. That search data are people now looking to get a new mortgage or to sell my house, or are more people looking to buy a house? You can see not the consumer confidence index in America, which gets created by sending out postcards to 5,000 people and hoping that some of them will come back and then saying, yeah, I guess the economy isn't doing all that well, versus having 10 million people observing their worries, their fears, their hopes. Dramatic different in terms of coming up with recommendations. And finally, that's the, I think, a game changer here are location data. For instance, there's a company in San Francisco called Scout, SKOUT.com, which has changed the dating game in San Francisco. That people are just, you know, having their mobile phone, they have their profile, and as they walk on the street, phone starts ringing, somebody else's phone starts ringing, you look at each other and you decide, well, not my type, and continue. Or maybe you say, hey, how are you doing? I'm Andreas. Last point on data is product data. These are all data sources which you should consider. And ultimately, people don't really care that much for your product. I hate to tell you that, Kimo. People just want to be safe. And they don't care about whether the option A or B or double C should be, just like in hotels. They don't care whether they have room type A, B, C, D, E. They want to just have a bed, maybe a big bed, and that's about it. Okay, then there's the social part on the left, namely your friends, meaning specific people you know, the ones you have conversation with. Viral marketing, I hear the word virus has different connotations in different groups. So for us, viral marketing is a good thing. That if I like something and I forward to my friends, then, you know, zero acquisition cost. Different from our last talk. Then there can be peers. For instance, G-Star is a company, I think, in Holland. And you have people who are really cool, and they went, so you go to them. And then finally, let's say you have experts, fashion bloggers, people who write restaurant reviews who can go to. So, recommendations, why to buy a product. The decision map is something which I don't want to go in here, but as you can see, it's way more beyond specs and product description, which you push to people and ask them to read. Ultimately, what we see here is a data revolution, not a software revolution. Mapping companies initially did not realize how much value users can add. Remember I asked you, don't think what can the ISP do for the user, but what can the user do for the ISP? That shift, which happened at Navtec after Nokia acquired them, partly that's the reason why Nokia acquired them 1.5 years ago, is that they said, hey, we have 100 plus million mobile phones with GPS. So why should we have 3,000 people drive and measure out the streets if we have 300 million people, that's five orders of magnitude more, already driving and mapping out the streets? What's happening, of course, is the business model are changing because who should be paying whom there? Should you pay me if I give you my data, or should I pay you to get the value-added product at the end about the traffic? You don't need complicated models to reinforce my point from before. You can just see how does the flow between you and Amsterdam go. In the morning, slow, in the evening, fast. And what would Amazon do? Well, to be honest, Amazon realized very early that users can add value. And I just use Amazon because I know it best. There are many other companies who do this, but you probably know Amazon reviews. A review is worth between $30 and $50 for Amazon.com. How do we know that? Hey, do you know the answer by now? Of course, we do experiments. We take the first review off and see how much do people buy. We put the first review in a book on and we see how much do people buy. And by the way, it doesn't matter whether it's a positive or negative review, because a negative review also supports the decision-making process of the customer by us knowing that, gee, you know, I'm glad I didn't buy that book because people say that other book is better. Google, beautiful example, Google Maps, are first thinking when somebody hacked into Google Maps, oh, we need to close that hole, and then Google realizing, gee, that guy is working for us for free. Because he is putting stuff in Google Maps, which, and that's when they opened up the API, and now the whole world actually makes Google Maps better maps. So think about it, how can the user help you as opposed to how can you help the user? I have a couple of myths, and the first myth actually consists of three sub-myths in my categorization, is that the company is in charge. So many companies used to think that they own the customer. You know, in the 90s, if you wanted to unsubscribe from America Online, from AOL, they put you in a waiting loop and you basically never got to it. Hey, we own the customer. And they made it really difficult for people to export their data. No more. The barrier of, you know, getting new services is very, very low. So in most cases, the customer knows how to get information about competitors' products very easily elsewhere. You don't own them anymore. It really has changed. A study 12 years ago showed that 90-something percent of all people buy a book at the first electronic bookstore they're arriving at. Nowadays, you know, people know how to compare stuff, and comparison shopping engines help them with that. Second one, well, the company thought they at least own their product. F-Secure. I am sure people here think, 40 people in F-Secure, they own the product. They know more than anybody else about the product. I don't know about F-Secure, but I do know about many consumer products I own, whether it's my camera or whether it's my phone, that the web knows more than Canon or than Nokia. If I have a question, as I said before, it's the web which answers the question, not some expert in some call center with a funny accent. Well, then what are we left with? At least we thought the company owns their brand. But then I think most of you know that in many cases that is not quite the case. And in those cases where people hope that they control it, there are some cases where that's not the case. I just want to show you yesterday's Dürbert for that, if I find it here, which precisely addresses the issue about brand management. Do you know Dürbert? Yeah. Here we are. I'll let you read it. Is it big enough for you to read, or should I read out? So what do we learn from that? What we learn from that is that there's a solution, and the solution is called persistent identity or reputation. So yes, of course, it is possible to write reviews, and indeed, a good number of messages are fake, no question about it. But if you give people a persistent identity, if you give them a way how they over time will look and will be able to see what they have written in the past, in that case, you can easily tell people who actually were just faking stuff. An example of such a platform with a persistent ID is GetSatisfaction.com. It's again a company in San Francisco, and their tagline is customer service is the new marketing. Customer service is new marketing, because they say, look, why do you spend millions of dollars to reach out to customers who you might have no chance of selling anything to, if you at the same time have millions of customers coming to you who already bought your product and want to know more? But we understand, they say, that the conversations don't always happen in the company, but the conversations often happen somewhere on the internet. So for instance here, as I mentioned, I have my little Nokia phone, and there was some interface bug. So I entered and I get popped to the Nokia page at this company called Get Satisfaction. Somebody had a problem, and there were three other people who had the same problem. Note that this easy way of instrumenting the world, of just having this button of pushing and saying, I have that problem too, helps Nokia, who has six employees ready to respond, sitting there, helps prioritize or rank or relevance, give relevance to what they should be doing. And indeed, somebody here just 8 days ago answered how to get rid of that problem. Think how that differs from how you do customer service. Comcast, a company, I'm not sure whether it's Comcast people here, is cable network in the United States, which provides pipes and provides service. And Comcast embraced Get Satisfaction, and they have special people whose job it is to do nothing but answer questions people have. Now, that's different from people calling the call center, because layer after layer, there will be a body of answers which is being created, and if somebody has a better solution, they can have a conversation, they can add to it here. So basically, it's opening up and letting other people help you. So again, the question is, how can you help have your users help you do stuff? Now, in the Comcast case, and with a platform like Get Satisfaction, it is no longer that customer network value is how many years will this person subscribe to F-Secure. But customer network value has another dimension to it, which is the dimension customer lifetime value of customer network value. Namely, if he was saved, his picture of his dog did not get eaten by the virus. He will tell all his friends and thus potentially have a much larger impact in what he tells others than only what he does himself. What would Amazon do? What we did was we created a feature called Share the Love. Stupid name, but that's what it's called. If you buy a certain book, after you check out, it tells you, hey, if you have any friends, give us their email addresses. And we are fair. If any of them buys the same book within a week, you get 10% back. He or she gets a 10% discount. And, you know, it's good for us too, because we maybe acquired another customer, at least we sold another book. So it's very interesting how that kind of marketing never gets perceived as spam. I've never heard somebody say, hey, Amazon spam me. It's my friend who's thinking about me that I might want that book. Do you see the shift? So marketing 2.0 is the buzzword which, you know, even the University of California at Berkeley adopts for their course now, which was went so well in the past that I have to teach it twice in the next quarter. So you don't have to worry, I won't be able to come back to Europe until the end of the academic year here. They are the old four P's of marketing: product, placement, pricing, and promotion. How dramatic that has changed. I could talk about each of them for an hour, but very quickly, product. Well, you learn about product by observing people's interaction with the product, and you can play with it. You can do hypotheses, you can do experiments, and you can do product development much, much, much faster than would you ever had before. Placement is no longer that you have to worry much where do you put stuff, but it's more like the user requests, it's more like discovery. Pricing, promotion, similar stories. So what's new? New is what we call ecosystem marketing. And what it is about is that you create a system where different parts interact, and that's your job, to create the system, to help to create the system, to play in that system. And there are other terms for this. I mentioned the F word already, feedback marketing. And there's a word called conversational marketing. The next slide shows you, if anybody has been in San Francisco in the last few months, shows you what everybody sees all the time on every street. And it tells you something. It says, hey, talk to Chuck, Charles Schwab. And there it says, call 800-4-Schwab, which of course I did. I said, hey, I want to talk to Chuck. I said, excuse me, what do you want? I want to talk to Chuck. Excuse me, how can I help you? Well, I called this number, I want to talk to Chuck. And it turns out it's just a lie. It's just as much as a lie that I can't talk to Chuck there as another financial institution sends me every month a report saying, a conversation with your fund manager. I've never talked to that guy. So I think, be honest in how you use terms. So I think the question what Amazon would do here is to genuinely think about how can we create an ecosystem so you can talk to those people who want to talk to you. I used to talk about C words, communication, conversation, stuff like this. Today I feel like talking about R words. I don't know why, but it has sort of happened this way. Reputation, relevance, and respect. I think it might have been because of these Vodafone messages that I didn't feel really that they were all relevant, reminding me every 5 minutes that I should top up now. And I didn't feel that they were respecting me actually as a customer. So reputation for me is what you gain over time, just like respect. If you treat people that you show them relevant information, for instance, relevant information for sure is when my virus software is running out, when I don't get updated anymore. In a way, the user wants it on his terms, which might be in a certain way, as an email, but not abusing, not raping their attention. Then I think you will gain the respect of the user. And for me, as a data person, ultimately, it means that we create an ever-growing pool of data for creating value for your customers and ultimately for yourself. So I've looked at the same thing in a number of ways. I could give you many more examples of data collection. Here's one which I got when I prepared this talk here. It says, privacy. allow S3, that's the Amazon storage, to access your camera and microphone. What do you think about that? Of course is the answer, yes. Because as they know more what I'm doing, hello camera, hello microphone, and the more they know, the better ads they can show to me, the more relevant they can be. But also, if they abuse it, the worse it is, and the worse the social media sphere will talk about them. Another couple of examples as I booked my flight here, from, in this case, an airline, of not instrumenting the word well. The United Airlines, they want to know whether I want to search by schedule or whether I want to search by price. While I know enough about the travel business that these are two different queries, as a user, I just want to know how I can get to Amsterdam. And I think it should have both a price and a schedule attached to it. So they try to map something and find out, is this Andreas Weigand price sensitive or does he just want to know the schedule? But a better way of this would have been what? To just present the results and then let me sort by price or let me sort by flight time or let me sort by schedule. That's the way which I think they would learn much more honestly from me what I really want than if they ask me, hey, schedule or price. Incidentally, when I made the reservation, they said, oh, would you like to lie with your flat towards the front or to the back? I said, what are you talking about? And it turns out that they have a new business class and you can lie in business class. They said, lie flat with your head in the front or head in the back. So immediately, of course, I go on the web and I see, these are all from this year, what does the social media sphere say about the new business class? And normally people are quite happy with things. And the first thing I learned, it doesn't lie flat and so on. The next guy says, you know, not very happy either. Third guy, very unhappy. And he says, you know, why could they not think out of the box? Why do I show this to you? I show this to you by making the point that people on the web talk about you a lot. And all you need to do is go out there and listen. So if United had spent the time of trying to figure out what people like and what people dislike, they wouldn't have invested millions and millions of dollars, I don't know how much it costs, to basically create a product which fair people, people don't have issues, access to grind, fair people here slashed in the first week when it came out. So three slides left. What really has changed? I think what has changed is the attitude of consumers, how they look for information, how they share information, both about themselves, including their hopes, fears, dreams, and their relationships. Tagging at Facebook is super interesting. If somebody tags me in a photo, you know, what is happening then? You need to think about your data strategy, and that goes way beyond privacy. Doppler, a company in London, has a beautiful concept where if you put your itinerary in, it shows you who else is having similar itineraries, and you might know these people. So for instance, if you come to this conference and you came to the conference last year, chances are you actually both came to the F-Secure conference. And then if you go to another conference, we'll say, hey, that guy who you were traveling to Amsterdam this year, to the other conference last year, he is there as well. Maybe you want to say hello. What's in for the businesses? If he is flying Lufthansa, maybe Lufthansa should make the other person a little deal. Do you want to guys sit together? And that might, or do you not want to sit together? And that actually might push him to take Lufthansa because he's safe or not safe from the other person. So that's data strategy is at the heart, but data isn't all. Experiments, trying out stuff is really now what the key differentiator is. Two final slides. I call this me business, the world we're in. We have moved to a customer-centric world where it's no longer about e-business, where the firm is in the center and the customers are being, you know, attacked with CRM systems. But it is that the user in the center, and I sometimes call this CMR, customer-managed relationships. Or Doc Searls at Harvard calls it VRM, vendor relationship management. So you see that flip like we had before, the flip in the direction. What can the user do for us as opposed to what we can do for the user? Second, F word. The system is engineered for feedback. I sometimes use the term, we want to instrument the world. I did my PhD in experimental physics, so I love instrumenting the world and finding out what people are doing now. GPS is so interesting to me because you can learn so much about the world. You leverage network effects. That was not only what the person says about himself or herself, but also what they say about others. And at the heart is, let users create value for you. Why do they do this? People often ask me. I don't know. I did a panel with Esther Dyson and Shoshana Zuboff at a Fortune magazine conference in Half Moon Bay last year. And there were interesting themes all of us had. And it really was that people want to spread their memes and their genes. So the genes are on Facebook and dating sites. The memes, they want to be long. They want to be immortal. They're self-interested too. So it is interesting, why do people actually help out companies? So finally, what is this consumer data revolution? We have moved from exploring and trying to exploit the digital shadow, as Kimo said, or as I sometimes say, to sniff the digital exhaust, which can be bad for your health, to empowering people to talk about themselves, to share and to make explicit, well-knowing contributions. And then finally, for people to also have this viral aspect, namely for people to bring in information about the relationships they have to others. So for me, the customer data revolution is the shift in expectations. That young people, older people like us, have very different attitudes to the data they create. If you think about it, I was born in the 50s. There was almost no data created about me in the first 5, 10, 15, 20 years. I would argue that today, with my mobile phone, I created more data than I created in the first 10 years of my life. What the main implications for you is, think about yourselves not as a transaction business, as a short-term transaction business, but think about yourselves as instrumenting the world, having instrumented the world as providers, measuring interactions in response to experiments you do in order to create true relationships with the customers and have them empower them to create true relationships with themselves. I want to thank Kimo, Antti, and Mari, who just were very, very kind inviting me and helping me with, you know, hopefully giving you some insights about what Amazon would do in this consumer data revolution world, and all of my friends in the F-Secure family, plus two friends in San Francisco, Ted Shelton, who runs the Conversation Group, and Mingyo Ng. And if you want to learn about Twitter, if you haven't heard about it, it's just www.twitter.com. What you should check out is follow Mr. Tweet, and you'll discover interesting things. My information is at Vigen.com, and I left about 5 to 10 minutes for questions. Thank you.
And I would imagine that there could be a couple of questions because I found this quite interesting. And I would like to start with a question myself because you said that people today are actually willing to talk to companies. But I would just add the qualifier that do you really mean that they are interested to talk to companies or are they more interested to talk to people in the company? And I'm kind of posing the question in the atmosphere of the Clutray Manifesto.
The Clutray Manifesto was written about 10 years ago, and I have on my little blog a 10-minute interview with Doc Searls, actually, on the 10th anniversary of the Clutray Manifesto, if you want to listen to a little MP3 file. And it said, markets are conversations. So many of the ideas which, you know, Amazon and other companies have in their DNA, actually people in the late 90s already realized. So to your question, I think that customers, consumers, individuals ultimately want to do things their way. I mean, not surprisingly. And what they demand is that there is more transparency. And these are all words you've heard many times, so listen carefully for a second. More accountability on the company side than I call a number and they know all about me. If I call Miles & More, the Lufthansa frequent flyer program, with my mobile phone, they say right away, hello, Dr. Weigand. Same for United Airlines. So they know who I am. They bring up the record, but I have no idea who I'm talking to. They record the conversation they have with me for whatever purposes they record these conversations. But I have no way. Why don't they send me an MP3 file afterwards of the conversation? So I also have, when I check in at the gate and said, you know, what about that upgrade the agent promised? What upgrade? Well, when I made the reservation, who did you talk to? I have no idea. I mean, you know, the agent I talked to, you know, who sold me this ticket? I don't know. Do you want to be in the flight or not? Next, please. So I think what people expect is to have some accountability. It's not a one-way mirror where the company sees all about you. Because when I make a reservation at United, they actually look up my schedule, my itinerary on Viking.com, and then figure out how much they're pricing. That's how it feels. But there should be some symmetry. So reducing this information asymmetry of the same playing field as, for instance, Get Satisfaction is doing it, that they are agents of the company as well as other users, is probably what direction the Crew Train Manifesto would be more than happy agreeing on moving in. It was too long an answer. Let's give them a chance here.
Questions, comments? Just a second, you'll get the mic.
Okay. Well, there's, it was an interesting insight into data usage of collected data from customers, and there's, on the other hand, a different framework all over the world from privacy laws, and so it would be interesting how Amazon managed to be always on the in the right discussion of this, because they have a big empathy on this issue, and how to pretend, perhaps you have an easy formula, how to pretend to get into the privacy discussion when using data analysis.
Good. I think the conversation really has shifted over the last 10 years. 10 years ago, it was quite difficult because European Union has very different laws from the United States, so the server were in the US, and you know, it's very complicated. And now I think what I have in mind here, I always said, what would Amazon do in this relatively new world, which Amazon didn't really move in? At Facebook, people happily share information about themselves. At Twitter, who of you uses Facebook? Okay, so about half the people. Who of you uses Twitter? 6 people only. So Twitter is the following. You can send from your mobile phone to a shortcut, so a few digits, a message up to 140 characters, which could be a quote you just heard, or it could be what you're having for breakfast, or that your flight is delayed again, whatever it is. And then the key thing about Twitter is not that you can send something, but it is public. Moving information from the private to the public is the key difference to the privacy discussion, that I say, hey, I'm aware that everybody can see that. And then you have a few followers, I have maybe 300-400 followers, who, you know, every week I tweet maybe twice or three times, are interested in what I have to say. And then I get feedback. If I start bugging them, then they will just unsubscribe. They won't follow me anymore. And so it's a very different communication medium from sending email. If Kimo sends me email, at some stage he assumes that I have read the email, or vice versa. Versus a tweet, nobody assumes that anybody sees anything. And it's very different from a blog where you have to actually... So Twitter is an interesting communication paradigm. The reason I'm talking about it is it moved things which used to be in the private sphere into the public sphere. There are problems because people don't evolve as fast as technology. Example, last year at the East Coast, the health insurance company was contacted by a mom, and her daughter had anorexia. Anorexia is an eating disorder. And, you know, as you can tell, I'm not particularly thin, so I don't have that problem. But what I've heard is that two kinds of anorexia, in some examples, the health insurance ought to pay. In other examples, they don't have to pay. The first thing the health insurance did was they got all the data they could find about that girl out of Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn, etc., in order to make the case, hey, if she talks to her friends like this on Facebook, we don't have to pay. Would she have ever thought, if she talked about that ice cream cone, that it will cost her $100,000? So your privacy conversation, which I was in high school in the 60s, and the Spider-Meinhof, and we had many issues in Germany at the time. But I think the conversation has so shifted. What value does the user perceive in exchange to giving, not really you data, to giving the world data? Data about themselves and data about their friends. And the other question, which is really the follow-up question, is who owns the data? Well, everybody owns the data. The question is who can modify it, and the hard question we have no answer is, what do you do if actually there is wrong data out about you?
And I guess that's a difficult one. Thank you very much, Andreas. I think we should continue the discussion over lunch now.